There are so many books out today.
So many. I know. So many.
Some that I've read, some that I haven't read.
Do tell.
Okay, the one that I read is A Better World by Sarah Langan. The one-liner is a devious thriller about a family seeking refuge within an exclusive enclave. Only the smiles and manicured lawns come with a price. Super good. And Sarah Langan was a part of the Palm Springs Readers Festival that I produced, and she's incredible. So I'm so excited for her and that book. And then I can't wait to read The Age of Magical Overthinking by Melissa Montel, because I am an overthinker, a capital O overthinker. In fact, I'm probably a capital O-V-E-R overthinker. And I just feel like she wrote this book about me. And it's light. So
it's speaking to you?
It's speaking to me. Notes on Modern Irrationality.
Interesting. I loved her last book.
And then the other one that I am so stoked to read is There's Going to Be Trouble by Jen Silverman. Mm-hmm. And Jen, their book, We Play Ourselves, came out a couple of years ago that people really loved. And Jen is also a playwright. There's Going to Be Trouble. A woman is pulled into a love affair with a radical activist, unknowingly echoing her family's dangerous past and risking the foundations of her future in this electrifying novel. The course of your life can change with one split-second decision.
That sounds great.
I know, right? And we are going to do a giveaway for multiple copies of this book. So make sure you're following us on Instagram at Kay's Reading so that you can see when that happens.
That's great. Also, our next biggest guest, Yulene Kwong's book comes out, How to End a Love Story. It's really great. And we had such a great conversation with her next week. And then two other books that I had that came out today that look both interesting. I know one was very interesting to you, was The Prospects by K.T. Hoffman.
Yes.
Which is a joyful, heartfelt debut rom-com revealing what's possible when we allow ourselves to want something enough to swing for the fences. It's a rom-com that deals with a trans baseball player. So that looks great.
The editor in their letter at the very beginning of the galley for that book says that within the first few chapters of The Prospects, she knew that this book would do for trans storytelling what Casey McQuiston did for the queer rom-com space with Red, White, and Royal Blue.
That's amazing.
I have a friend that read it. Shout out to Ashley. She read it months ago and then wanted to read it again just before Pub Day so she could talk about it. So has read it multiple times, loved it so much.
That's great. And then the other thing that's coming out today that looks really heartwarming and wonderful is called The Fellowship of Puzzle Makers. It's an extraordinary, gloriously uplifting novel about the power of friendship and the puzzling ties that bind us. It is a story about love and family and what it means to find your people, no matter what age you are. So this sounds like great in the way that a good heartwarming story, which we all could use those. And I also saw that the audiobook, Russell Tovey is one of the readers of it. And I love me some Russell Tovey. Oh, and the last thing, which is a big one for a lot of people, is The Fellowship. Or The Familiar, sorry, by Leigh Bardugo, which is set in the Spanish Golden Age, and her latest thriller, which is getting great reviews and raves from people. So I'm excited to read that.
And there are so freaking many books. Also coming out today, The House of Broken Bricks by Fiona Williams. Every marriage has its seasons. It's autumn when we meet Tess, but her marriage to Richard is in a deep, cold winter. A winter so harsh, their union may never see the bright light of spring. Love or relationship drama. Also, Rough Trade by Tarina Carrasco. The beloved gender-fluid anti-hero Alma Rosales is back. Rough Trade is a heady feast for the senses that explores reimagined queer communities, the turbulent early days of modern media and medicine, and the pleasures and price of satisfying desire. I just need to pause so that I could read every book that comes out today, because I'm just so excited for all of them. I don't think we've ever shouted out this many books.
I don't think we have either. And also, like, we were talking quickly yesterday and just said, April has been on fire. And there are so many amazing books coming out and so many great ones that have already come out that there's just not enough time. But God, there's just this books right now are just fantastic.
Thank you to all of our listeners that keep listening and listen to us babble on about books and who go and buy them to support our authors and just authors in general and local bookstores or libraries, wherever you're getting your books. It's wonderful. And if you like what you're hearing, please share us with your friends. We have seen a growth in our numbers, which is so exciting. And that's a testament to you, our listeners. So we're so grateful for that. And if you can follow us wherever you listen to podcasts, click subscribe, because some of you might not know this, but we don't get paid to do this podcast. And to see numbers grow is what can get sponsors to want to support us. So if you even just click subscribe, it'll bring our download numbers up, which is super helpful. And we're grateful and appreciative of that. You can buy merch, and the link to buying our merch is in our show notes. You could join our Patreon, which is also the link is in our show notes. And all of the books that we talked about, both just now and on the episode and on every episode, can be found in our bookshop.org page. Also, the link in our show notes. Today, we have Holly Gramazio. Her book, her debut, The Husbands, was just announced as April's Read with Jenna book club pick.
People are loving this book. People are loving it.
So much fun. Holly Gramazio is a writer, game designer, and curator from Adelaide, currently based in London. She founded the experimental games festival, Now Play This, and wrote the script for the award-winning indie video game Dicey Dungeons. Her recent projects include New Rules, a zine collecting essays about play during the pandemic, and a collaboration with artist Lawrence Leck on a game for his exhibition, Nox. She's particularly interested in rules, play, cities, gardens, games that get people acting creatively, stories that buy into a ridiculous premise and then really commit to it, and art that gets people interacting with their surroundings in new ways. The Husbands is her first novel. I am obsessed with Holly Gramazio. And on that note, I'm Jason. And enjoy this episode of Gays
Reedy.
Do not disturb my phone.
Oh, good idea. If I can even.
Do not disturb bone.
Yes. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I'm so excited. I'm excited to talk to you, but I'm more excited to say your name. I'm obsessed with your name.
Incredible. Let's try it.
I imagine you as a Sopranos character. Hey, it's Holly Gramazio.
Oh, well done. Nice. Good work. Right?
Which is so stupid, but I'm like, have fun. Are you Italian? You must be Italian.
I'm not. My stepdad, my now ex-stepdad, was Italian. So he and my mum got married when I was 6 or 7. She changed her name. I changed my name because I was 6 or 7. And then they eventually divorced like 20 years later. But I'd grown up with the name. My brothers have the name. They're half-brothers, technically. I want to keep the same name as them. Got used to it. Also, are 9 million people called Holly Matheson, which is what I was until I was 6.
Oh.
There are so many Holly Mathesons. I think there's even a minor character in one episode of Cheers called Holly Matheson. And as far as I know, there are no other Holly Gramazios, because it is an Italian name. It's from Benevento. And most Italians aren't called Holly.
Holly. So, you'd be like, that's Tina.
But this is why I said I'm obsessed with your name. It's like,
so I get to have this name that's just mine.
And you have an accent to me. So hearing it in the accent, it's like Italian chef's kiss. It's so nice to meet you.
It's so nice to meet you.
I'm so excited to talk about The Husbands, your debut novel. I was saying to Brett, I read the whole thing on a plane the other day. And it was just like the most joyful way to spend a cross-country plane ride. I know it's terrible to tell authors that you read a book in one sitting very quickly because you worked on it for a very long time.
No, I love it. One of my very favorite feelings when I'm reading is that sort of 2 a.m. I really should go to sleep, but I know I'm not going to. I know I'm going to keep reading for another half an hour to an hour and a half, oops, feeling. So I am so delighted when it turns out that someone read it in this huge sort of haphazard careering rush.
I was stuck on a plane, so I had nowhere to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you do. It's compelling because you have to know who's coming down next.
I know. For our listeners that have not had a chance to read it yet, do you have an elevator pitch for the book?
Okay, so this is the shortest version that I've managed. It's a novel about a woman named Lauren whose attic starts creating an infinite supply of husbands. So that's a very short version. The slightly longer version is Lauren gets back one night after her best friend's hen party and she finds that her husband is waiting up for her. And this is really weird because when she went out to the party, she definitely wasn't married. But his face is a photo on her lock screen. There's a wedding picture up on the wall. And also it's 3 a.m. and she has been at a party until now. So she's quite drunk. So she just barricades herself in the living room and figures she'll work it all out in the morning. But then in the morning, when she goes to talk to him about it, he's, just a second. I just need to change a light bulb in the attic. And he climbs up into the attic. And then when he climbs down, he's a different man. And she slowly figures out that her attic is creating this infinite supply of husbands for her. Each time a man climbs up, a different man climbs down.
So funny. That premise alone is just, I couldn't wait to read the book. It's obviously very Groundhog Day adjacent. Have you always been drawn to that style of story?
Yeah, I've always loved the sort of story where it's essentially realist, maybe a comedy, but there's just one big thing that's different about the world, one thing that kicks a story off.
It's funny you say that because my husband was like, you love magic realism. And I was like, I don't actually love magic realism. I love when a world is for the most part normal, but there's a hint of something that's unexplainable. And I think that's essentially a Groundhog Day style story and the husband style story. That's what this is going to turn into. We're not going to call it Groundhog's Day anymore. It's going to be the husband's.
The husband's day.
I'm obsessed that you're a game designer. And
What kind of games?
Like people people physically doing something physically in the world.
I am one of the reasons I'm so excited about having written a novel is that I can now at parties just say, oh, I'm a novelist and not have to try to explain my incredibly complicated games work, which involves making games often for festivals or museums or art galleries, sometimes for events, sometimes they're a one-off thing that happens, sometimes it's a physical installation in a museum. I've also done card games and other tabletop games. I've done some little digital work. I've written the script for a couple of video games. Essentially, anything that's about play and interaction and words and places and in some sort of combination.
And what was the journey? Clearly, you're creative. You're coming up with these stories for the games. You said you've written scripts for video games. Is that sort of how the transition into writing a novel came? And did you always want, you clearly always wanted to write a novel?
I definitely always just assumed that I would eventually get around to writing a novel at some point, and maybe it wouldn't get published, but at least give it a good go and see how it happened. And then I realized that, unfortunately, it wouldn't just happen without me doing anything, and I would have to actually sit down and spend a whole bunch of time on it. Otherwise, I would get 80 and go, now will be the time when I magically turn out to have written a novel.
How convenient would that be if that was the magic realism part of your life? You just thought about a book and it appeared.
Right.
Yeah.
She's in that moment.
Gentle fantasizing.
I know. She really went there. She was like, there was her sliding door. Also, in a way, you create this choose your own adventure book, which is so.
Yeah. There's definitely a little bit of game thinking that's gone into it. I think there's something when you're designing a game, quite often you're trying to figure out, what will people be thinking at a particular time? What might they try to do within the game? And as a player, it feels really good if the game responds to you, if it sees what you're doing and gives you some sort of reward. So a lot of the structuring of the husbands was me having that kind of thoughts about it. If I were reading this, what might I be wanting Lauren to try? What might I be wondering about how the whole system works? What might I be making up in my head and going, I wonder if this is going to happen? So I'm trying to time the events and experiments and revelations to run, hopefully, roughly alongside what people are thinking. Maybe sometimes a little bit sooner, sometimes a little bit later, but roughly have Lauren's realizations and experiments keep pace with when the readers are going, oh, but what about this?
Yeah.
Something you've talked about is that different versions of your life are sometimes quite nearby. And that's something that you played with a bit in The Husbands. Are there things in your life that you've experienced that you could point to that you can give as examples of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My whole game design work is essentially the result of a really elaborate series of events that goes back to a misfiled book in a secondhand bookshop in Adelaide in South Australia, which is where I'm from, where I grew up. I live in London now. But yeah, I went looking for some written poetry with parallel translation to English, because that's the kind of slightly unbearable teenager I was. And I found misfiled in the like foreign language poetry section a book called Metamagical Themas by Douglas Hofstadter, which is this collection of early 80s columns from Scientific American, where he just plays with different ideas around language and games and writes these very long, fun, discursive essays on them. And I went, this sounds like fun. Okay, why not? Bought that, read it, and found a chapter about a game called, which is a game where you vote to change the rules during the course of the game. So the game vaguely evolves as you play it. I thought that sounded great. Eventually, I found some people playing it online and I joined in with a game of that for a while. Didn't really actually love playing it, but made friends with some of these people, continued to play games with them, started messing around with the idea of designing games and thinking about that as something to actually do on a on an ongoing basis rather than an occasional weekend hobby. And from there, basically everything else, my current work, all of my friends, where I live, the kittens, all of these things trace back to this one misfiled book.
I am obsessed with those sorts of stories. And I feel like I'm very grateful that I have happened to have stories like that in my own life. But even something as simple as you were just talking about a song with somebody and you walk into a coffee shop and that song is playing, that has happened too. And I think it's fun when we really think about and pay attention to our surroundings and see the little nods from the universe, little winks from the universe saying you're doing the right thing or we're paying attention or whatever. I love that.
Yeah.
Now, when you went into this, did you write out a prototype? Did you have ideas for many of these husbands? Did they begin to reveal themselves to you as you went through it? How did that work?
Oh, you know the thing that some writers say about how the characters come to them fully formed and then they try to start capturing the characters? That is not how it works for me, even a little bit. Obviously, I've written one book, so who knows? But what seems to happen, and this is how a lot of games works as well for me, is that I start by thinking about situations and moments, just a moment of emotion, and then try to form everything else around it and go, I know I want to have this moment, I want to have this visual image, I want to have this emotion. What might fit around that? So, for example, the husband descending from the staircase, like standing in a hallway looking up at an attic, waiting to find out who's going to climb down, was one of those key things. But it's similar with characters as well. Think about what they're going to be doing, what situations they're going to be in, and then what sort of person they would have to be for that to make sense. And then once I start writing them, I figure out more about them through that process. But it's definitely a kind of like functional thing. So Lauren, for example, is very bad at making decisions. I'm also quite bad at making decisions. So this is definitely something I've clawed out of myself and formed into the little clay model of Lauren, right? But but the specific way she's bad at making decisions is just being afraid of getting things wrong, not wanting to commit to stuff, avoiding making a decision in case it's not the right one. And she's like that because that's the sort of person where it makes sense for her to have this particular type of magic attic, right? She has to be someone who would broadly go along with things. These husbands are going to climb down. She has to be someone who would live in a place and kind of continue to live in it by habit, because otherwise she wouldn't have that many lives where she's under this particular attic, right? She'd have a bunch where she's off in Spain or Australia or South America or wherever it might be. She had to be someone who was quite static in that way. And that kind of gives me a sense of who the person is. And then I start writing and find out more from there.
And did you ever, with these, again, with these men, because I almost think you could write one, write another one, and then piece them together in terms of how you want them to appear.
Yeah, that is absolutely what happened. I wrote maybe, but the final novel is about 100,000 words long, but I wrote maybe 150,000 words of just disconnected scenes, mostly bits and pieces and jokes and scenes and chapters and husbands and long lists of men who might exist, and then just had this huge pile of words to work with. And
of men, you could say it.
Yeah, of men, this huge pile of men, and then began shaping them and getting them into a line and seeing how that worked. People talk about whether you writers plan things in advance or just start writing and see where it goes. And I'm this very inefficient third thing where I write a bunch of stuff and that's created the lump of clay that I then use to plan things.
That's amazing. Yeah, I know. My husband and I have been together for a little over 10 years, and we first moved in together like 9 months after we started dating. And when we were looking for our first apartment, he has a science background. He works in technology. He's a very smart man. But he, as we were talking about deciding on an apartment, he taught me about optimal stopping. And this book is a book. This literally is a book about optimal stopping. That's what this book is.
It is. And there's a whole little lecture on it.
Yes, you don't use the terms optimal stopping, but the 37% is literally the optimal stopping algorithm. Basically, Brett, the idea, and our listeners, the idea is, let's say apartment hunting. I was apartment hunting. If we put together our list of wants, then let's say we're seeing 10 apartments. Once we hit 3.7 apartments, once we see 3.7 apartments, after that, we stop when we see the full list of things, right?
All right.
So if we get to apartment number 6 and it has everything that we're looking for, we don't see apartment number 7 because that's going to be the optimal time to stop. I was like, oh, that is literally what this book is about. And I was obsessed. I know you're married. I assume you're still married because your bio reflects as such. You were on your dating journey. I was a serial dater. I have a long list of gents that I went on a date with, two dates with. Was that your experience? Did you collect from your life?
Not really. I'm very much a long-term relationship kind of person. So I've had maybe 4 long-term relationships in my life. And each time one of those entered, I would go, now I'm single. I'm going to be a glamorous single lady. I'm going to drink cocktails and wear a fancy dress out in the town. And
same
it's
girl.
Kind of
same.
Or just in your living room.
Same.
Yeah. But then basically 2 months later, it's like a bell goes off and whoever I'm standing next to, we're in a long-term relationship now. We move in together. That lasts at absolute minimum 2.5 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So it is a little bit like Lauren's experience of just having husbands parachuted into her hallway, right? Except not quite as efficient.
Now that I'm no longer a serial dater in a long-term relationship, I am obsessed.
Now that you've sealed your attic.
Now that I've sealed my attic, I am obsessed with swiping for my friends. And so when you talk about that in the book, I was like, oh my God, I relate so deeply. Brett, I don't know if you have
Do many of them let you swipe? No, the closest I've come to this is I took pictures for a friend of mine with the dog when he was loading stuff up on one of these apps. Because I was like, everybody loves a dog. It doesn't have to be yours. And I have this beautiful golden retriever. So I was like, sit here with the dog. If you want to take your shirt off with the dog, that's fine too. But those will get you likes.
No, my friends let me swipe.
Wow.
Yeah, mine too. They hand the phone and that's so overcome with weariness of this never-ending carousel of faces that they're just like, pick some for me.
And you hope it's just faces. Is it, they literally say to you, pick some for me?
Yeah, sometimes.
When you swipe right.
Sometimes they want you to show them before you approve them. But sometimes they're just like, no, whatever, I can't bear to look at any more. Just make some decisions. And I always have to go, which one's good, which one's bad? I can never remember which direction is which. It's very unintuitive to me. Sometimes I'll accidentally press a button and go, oh no, I've super liked someone. I'm so sorry. And I just go, it doesn't matter.
You're getting married now. Sorry.
Say, it doesn't matter. I don't care. None of this really means anything. That happens all the time. Every individual swipe is invested with so much insignificance, this tiny little chore.
I could never do this. I really couldn't, because I would be the person who would be so invested and be like, why didn't they swipe me? Why? I couldn't do this.
Yeah, you're too emotional.
I am. I really am. I couldn't do it.
Speaking of friends, I was obsessed that Lauren had people around her who were just like on board. You always need that friend who's, you could say whatever You could say, I just robbed a bank, or this crazy magical thing has just happened. And the friend is like, cool, I believe you. I trust you. Let's figure out how to solve your problem. And we all need those friends. Do you have someone in that like that in your life?
Yeah, I guess I'm lucky. I have a few friends who are in that sort of, we'll just go along with whatever or have whatever conversation, or even if they think something you're saying is nonsense, we'll engage in the nonsense with you, which is just a really lovely thing to have. Like, I remember one of them sneaking into the theatrical viewing of High School Musical 3. We are like a decade too old for High School Musicals, but just watched them when we were housemates and got very obsessed with them. And then when the third one came out with the cinematic release, we were incredibly excited about that. So we booked tickets on opening night at 9 in this local suburban multiplex. Got there an hour early because we were so overexcited, and also maybe there'd be a huge queue. There was not a huge queue. So we went over the road to the supermarket and got a bottle of fizzy wine and then opened that and started drinking it before we went in. But then because we were so overexcited, we had not even drunk very much of it and had to go into the cinema. And then had this sort of elaborate series of events where she said, oh, I'm really good at not spilling wine. And I had a balloon in my bag because of some game events I'd been running. This is not a euphemism and me trying to hide the fact that I had a condom in my bag.
It was literally a balloon.
Like a bright blue balloon.
Yeah.
Put it over the top of the bottle of fizzy wine because that would stop it spilling in our bags.
And no,
right? You're ahead of me on this one.
Oh my God.
It turns out that fizzy wine gives off all of these little bubbles. And so he was standing in the queue with this balloon poking out of the bag, gradually expanding while we tried to hide it with the pom-poms that we had bought outside the High School Musical 2 stage show when we'd gone to see that, which we'd brought along, just terrified that we would get kicked out and not be able to see this film that we were so overexcited for. Obviously, the person manning the 9 p.m. Wandsworth Cineworld showing of High School Musical 3 does not care. You do not have to hide your bottle of fizzy wine from this underpaid teenager.
Then we went in
and it was just us. And then just before it started, two other people turned up. And it was just one of the nicest evenings, this series of quite bad, overexcited decisions, but quite minimally bad, quite trivially bad, just silly things that involved, that required overinvestment in this thing we'd decided to care about.
What's this friend's name?
Carrie.
Carrie. Shout out to Carrie. We all need a Carrie. We love you, Carrie, if you happen to listen to this. And if not, in spirit, those Carries in the world, we love you.
We're opening some sparkly wine for you.
Oh my God.
Sans balloon.
Something complete non sequitur, but I need to make sure we talk about this. And for all I know, we're going to end up talking about it for the entire rest of this conversation. All of the 98% of the husbands have names. Mm-hmm. There is only one time where Lauren is like, oh, yeah, that person looks like the name that they have. And that is, he looks like a Jason.
Ah, it's true.
What does a Jason look like to you? Asks the Jason.
Yeah. I think, this is difficult. I guess key for Jason in the book is that he has nice dark hair. That's a thing that she notes about him.
Sure.
And I see you also have that. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, what does
our
a
listeners,
Jason
Jason's
look
posing
like?
Right now.
What does Jason look like? I know. I read that and I was like, whatever does she mean? But it's just so funny. You like literally do not ever say that the entire rest of the book. But hilariously, I was at a restaurant the other day that we go to quite regularly. And there's this guy that's always working there. And we've never asked his name. And in my mind, he's a Steve. He was not Steve, but he was like giving Steve. His name was Eric. And I was disappointed because I was like, this is not Eric to me. No. So I guess when you know it, or when you see it, you know it, or you'll know it when you see it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to remember whether I know socially any Jasons that were inflecting that. Why did I think that a Jason has a particular type of look?
I know.
I have to be honest. I picture you sitting at parties or get-togethers or wherever and talking with someone or friends or husbands of friends and suddenly being like, okay, this is one of the husbands. I'm writing this one down right now. That's how I picture this research went. Anybody that came across you, you were suddenly like, oh, okay, this is a good quirk. I'm throwing this one in.
I definitely stole some sort of habits.
I know. I'm waiting for you to have friends to call and say, is this David? Just let me know. Is this David? Is this how you see him? Or whoever. Insert name here.
One of the moments that someone gets sent immediately back up the ladder is he's wearing shoes with individual toes. And I was like, oh yeah, that totally tracks. Go back up. You have said that it's someone with jewelry that you would probably send somebody right back up. Has that changed for you? Do you have something else, something new?
Not really. I really don't like jewelry. I never wear jewelry. Something about it just makes me slightly uncomfortable. Even shaking hands with someone with rings, it's fine because I'm a grown-up person who knows how to shake hands. But if I think about it too much, I'm a little bit, and the more it goes through skin, the less I like it. I think the thing going on with there is that jewelry is terrible, is my conviction. What if the person wearing it suddenly realizes it's terrible and tears it off? If it's a necklace, necklaces are basically fine. If you suddenly tear a necklace off because you realize it's terrible, then that's fine. You've just broken a necklace. But earrings, for example, or sort of nose rings or whatever, if you realize
nose
they're
nipple,
terrible
you
and suddenly tear them out, then that's horrifying. So I could just definitely could not date someone with an earring, a nipple ring, anything like that. It would just dismay me too much.
Where do we think that comes from?
I do not know. It's interesting, isn't it? I definitely remember when I was 9 or 10 or so, I had a little necklace, which I didn't find deeply repellent. So definitely sometime after that, I think probably it's that sort of early teenage thing where all of this stuff starts having meaning and like what songs you like mean something. So I just didn't listen to any pop music for 10 years because I was too stressed out by the signaling that was associated with different types of music.
Sure.
And I think it probably came around that same sort of thing. I don't want to have to engage with any of the significance of that when people are allowed to get their ears pierced, when people give each other necklaces, friendship bracelets, all of that kind of thing. Too complicated, disgusting, nothing to do with me. And I've just never really examined it or tried to like work through that because honestly, it's very convenient to not like jewelry because you save a bunch of money.
Yeah. We talk a lot about dreams on the podcast. And just yesterday we were talking to an author and there was something about if you're dreaming and you don't know you're dreaming, does that make it real? And I wonder if there are times when we like dream about things, we think it's a real moment. And then in turn, that's where some of our convictions come from. It's
maybe
waking up and I'm mad at my husband, but I'm only mad at him because of something that happened in my dream. So maybe it's something like that. You're allowed like jewelry for any reason. You don't even have to have a reason, but it is just interesting like where some of those things come from.
Clearly, I was just curious. Do you think there's the idea of a perfect match for somebody?
No, I don't. I'm very fond of my husband. I think he's great. I imagine that if we weren't together, there's a reasonable chance that we'd be with other people. And that might also be great in a different way. I think one of the things that I was really keen to do with writing The Husbands was try to acknowledge that there's a really wide range of how suited a person is to you and how much you like them and like how good that relationship is. It's not, oh, anyone will do. We should all pair up at random. But that the sense of there being like one true person and we just have to hunt them down is erroneous. Mm-hmm. There's one or two husbands in there that I think most readers find particularly appealing. And I did work on making those feel beguiling. I wanted it to feel sad that they don't necessarily work out.
Yes, yes. Jason and I are having this conversation. I was very upset by this.
Brett was complaining to me. And I was like, Brett, there's always going to be the one that got away.
I know. You know what
and it wasn't meant to be.
No, it's the romantic in me who wanted to steer the course. Like I'm you know, not giving anything away, but I was sure, like, I was like, oh, I know where this is headed now. And when things changed slightly, I was very upset, which is a testament to say I said this because I wanted to believe. I'm someone who I don't believe, like I've always said to people, if you find someone that has 65 to 70% of your boxes checked, that's a good match. That's a really good, because not all of us can be Joanne Woodward and Paul Newman. That just
Dan Savage, the sex columnist, says you're never going to find the one. So you need to round up from the 0.87 or whatever it is.
I agree.
So that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. But I am sure there will be readers who are a little bit annoyed that it doesn't work out with one or the other of the particularly enticing husbands, as it were.
Sure, the book is called The Husband. Clearly, it's not going to work out with all of them.
She also has neighbors downstairs. And
we love the neighbors.
I love the neighbors as well. But one of the things that I was thinking about when I was writing it was the way that stories are shaped is that normally, if you spend a lot of time with your heroine going through a bunch of different men in search for someone who suits her, the shape of the story implies that, oh, she'll end up with the neighbor who lives downstairs, who she's been friends with all along and never saw standing there, blah, blah, blah. So what can I do to make it clear that's not what's happening? And that ended up being one of the most fun chapters to write, the series of events where it becomes clear that no, this is not a guy that will work out for her. But yeah, it was definitely came logistically slightly from thinking, I want to have him down there. I want to have someone that she can hang out with who lives in the house, but I do not want people to get to the end and feel cheated by that particular trope not being fulfilled.
Yes. Yeah. I also love what you do, speaking of these extraneous characters, the very subtle thing you do with the changes that happen everywhere. Like you describe the house, first of all, maybe a picture has changed or something, but also the way that life that she's in now with whomever changes the surrounding areas as well. It's such a subtle but great thing, but it made me think so much about, oh my God, the ramifications are bigger here, that what are these relationships and what do they all mean and how have they been established, and down to family and what that is. Really interesting.
Yeah, that was good fun to write as well. Did a lot of just sitting and thinking what about different ways that my own life has been affected by friends' relationships and family's relationships, and what are possible knock-on effects of the different ways that Lauren's life could be.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a theme in the book, too, about things being both normal and different at the same time. And that's a really, I think, interesting thing to think about, ways that our lives can change and yet feel right.
Yeah, the range of different types of people that we might be, the different ways things might have gone and still have been pretty good, correct for us. One of the things that would have worked.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that happens in The Husband is that Lauren feels out the edges of what she's happy with, how much transformation is okay with her, what versions of herself are versions that she can be and what are just not right for her.
Yeah, there, when you're going through the same exercise over and over again, she really is continuing to learn about herself as she goes. Have you had experiences in your life where you can relate in that specific way? Oh, the more you've done this one thing, you've sort of changed. I mean, I guess that's just living.
Yeah, absolutely. I think even without going into like parallel universes, we all have the different versions of us that were around in the past. And sometimes those different versions are plexing. I mentioned the 10 years when I didn't listen to any pop music because I just was just too intimidated by the sort of messaging and like subgroup formation around it. I also didn't like pubs. When I first moved to the UK, I found the sort of rules of social engagement here a little bit baffling. And so I just didn't really go to pubs, which is the main place that people hang out.
Have you thought about it being three-letter P words?
Oh, interesting. But jewelry has so many letters. It's
pop
that.
And pub.
Pub. Yeah, interesting. And I had a year where I was like, okay, every month I'm going to go to a pub, even if I hate it, I get to tick that off my list of to-do things. And then by the end of the year, I could no longer remember why I'd been so uncomfortable. Now, I don't know what I was feeling when I was there. I do not understand that anymore. I just remember how strongly I felt it. And I know that version of me wouldn't understand the current version of me either. So even with our own lifetime, sometimes over quite short periods, you have this very sort of this wall of incomprehensibility.
That's such a good example.
How much more?
So something else that is talked about in the book and just the different universes and the different people that you can become, the idea of having this quote unquote time where you can, in the book, you say, learn theoretical physics, become flawless playing piano. What do you think you would do if you had this time? What would you want to achieve?
Yeah. Okay. Great. So one of the things with the husbands that's different from, for example, Groundhog Day and Palm Springs and Russian Doll and your time loop is that you don't have an infinite amount of time. The year keeps rolling on while she's doing all of this stuff. She has a birthday, her niece and nephew get older, the flowers come out and then die, right? So she doesn't get this
reset
gift,
right? It's not the
gift of infinite time, yeah, right? But if I had that, if I could just take a year or 10,000 years to sit around and do stuff, more language learning, although it's difficult if you don't get to talk to people. So you definitely need this to be the sort of magical time where there are still other people around, but they're unaware of the time loop. You couldn't do Frozen Universe that you can move through at will. If I did get Frozen Universe, you can move through at will, I'd just go to all of the museums and slightly rearrange some stuff and sleep in every major museum in London.
That's a fun answer.
Yeah, not do any work.
Infinite resources.
Yeah, for a while. Like, if you've got infinite time, then just spend a year not doing any work. Catch up on your reading.
Yeah. Do you speak any languages besides? Do you speak any other languages?
I speak a bit of Italian.
It's your last name.
Ramazio.
Literally because it's my last name. My family, my stepfamily growing up around them, they spoke a lot of Italian, but I never really learned any. And I really wish I'd put in the effort because I had nothing else to do. I was nine. I would have got so much further, so much faster, but I didn't. But I have always been slightly embarrassed to have the surname and not speak any of the language. So then when the pandemic hit in early 2020, I just decided, okay, now is the time to do something about it. And I started having weekly lessons and began learning. And I'm still doing that. It's a lot of fun. Very excited that the husband is going to be translated into Italian, so I'll be able to practice by reading the thing I wrote in the language I'm trying to learn.
What a neat thing that you're going to be able to do.
Were there any men in your book, any husbands that you had a particular affinity for that you were like, oh, I love this one. I love this one so much.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Choosing your favorite child.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
no, I've got a couple.
It happens. Come on.
There's a quite late husband called Zach who is very poorly suited to Lauren, but who I really like and who is probably the most similar to my actual husband. He's good-natured. People like him. He's relatively laid back. Because of the circumstances of their meeting, Lauren's in no real state to consider him as a possibility. But I think I had to marry one of the husbands. He'd probably be pretty well suited to me. And there's also an Australian husband, Borhai, who is just such a relief to write, partly because of the time the husbands are all English. And I've been here 15 years, but I am Australian and there's still bits of my sort of vocabulary and ways of forming sentences that they bed in and that you don't really lose that. And so constantly going, would an English man say this? Would an English man think that? And for Lauren as well, would an English woman have this sort of attitude to things? Is this the word that she would use? And lots of stuff slipped through. So, for example, the downstairs neighbour, Toby, for a long time was called Hayden because he's a man in his mid-30s. And I'm like, all men in their mid-30s approximately are called Hayden, right? No, that's all Australian men in their mid-30s.
Oh, funny.
English men who are called Hayden are often called Hayden instead. and they're mostly maybe 25 at the oldest. Having an Australian character where I could just lean into that and not constantly be like at a slight remove of trying to make sure that I wasn't messing up the English felt
interesting. And he's like also such an important character for Lauren too. So
yeah, being able to write their friendship and the time they spent together as well, like just a real joy to write those chapters.
Yeah. So much of the book is about commitment and accepting fate and trusting your own instincts. And the magic realism of the book provides a buffer for you to be able to see yourself in the situation in a way that's not as literal as a straightforward romantic comedy.
Yeah, that's really good to hear. I guess that's what it's there for. I'm glad to hear it worked for you.
Yeah, but what's interesting about it, I agree with you 100%, but it's also the thing, upon reflection, it hits a little harder when you start to think about what it's actually saying and the themes that it's bringing up. These ideas, you said, Jason, of commitment, of what is, who is the right match.
In addition to being a book about optimal stopping, I think really is a book about the question, if something is abundant, can it be special?
Yeah. That's a lovely way of putting it. I like that a lot. I'm going to write that down. Yeah, I mentioned earlier that I'm bad at making decisions. And I'm bad at making decisions in a couple of different ways. One is that I'm worried about making the wrong decision, which is Lauren's situation. And another is that I'm very resistant to other people making decisions for me, which is like Borja's situation and his way of being bad at making decisions. But I'm great at making decisions for other people. So had a friend for a while who we had a standing agreement that she could phone me if she was feeling overwhelmed in a supermarket, for example, and say, what toothbrush should I buy? And I would just say, oh, second row down, is there a blue toothbrush? And she'd go, yes. And I'd say, how much does it cost? And she'd tell me, and I'd say, okay, it's too much. Is there a cheaper blue toothbrush? She'd go, yes. It costs £2.40. And I'll go, that's the toothbrush. And it did not matter at all. She only did this two or three times, but just like, having the agreement there, I think, was fun and useful. And I think there is something about this huge array of possibilities with toothbrushes or jams or faces on a dating site or whatever it might be that makes it hard to see each one individually and think about it. And sometimes that doesn't matter. Like, it genuinely doesn't matter which toothbrush you end up with.
It's still going to clean your teeth.
Toothbrushes.
Right.
Yeah, it's gonna approximately do its job roughly as well as any other toothbrush. But it does matter when you're picking a partner and you get that same sort of smoothing effect, that same sort of excessiveness of possibilities when you're going through a dating app or even going through a speed dating event or whatever it might be. But yeah, it really makes it hard, I think, to look at individual people as people rather than just another chore to get through.
And then there's the flip side too. Well, I've been using the same kind of toothbrush for 15 years. Why would I deviate from that? Or it's, you don't even realize that there are other toothbrushes that can do more things for your teeth or whatever. When someone's in a relationship for so long, I think it's easy to get used to that one thing, the constant. There's that opposite of you have the abundance, it can't be special. And then that one thing can't be special. So it's really finding that balance of continuing to do the work and make it special.
Yeah, it's true. I think one of the things that's slightly difficult for Lauren is that when she does end up in these new relationships, she doesn't have that intertwining of lives and decisions in her head. She's just parachuted into where that ended up. And sometimes that's great because it means that she can see that someone isn't right for her and hurry him back into the attic immediately without getting caught up on logistics and, but they had such a big expensive wedding and her sister who told her that they shouldn't get together will be so smug if they break up and all of this other like paraphernalia. But yeah, sometimes it's difficult because it means that she can't see why a life might work for her.
And why if what they're doing is wearing shoes with individual toes is the worst offense, that maybe everything else is so good. There
yeah.
is yeah, no jewelry. Fine.
Let's be honest. There must that's be pretty some bad, sort of, though.
But there must be something magnificent that caused her to overlook this, right?
Right, because she married him.
Yeah, right. Probably he didn't, like, 7 years into the relationship, just go, I'm an individual toes shoe guy now. Probably she found out about that early on, and she was like, oh, you know what? Okay, why not? Why not?
I don't know. I went from a regular old toothbrush to an electric toothbrush. You never know how things can change. Have you ever worn those shoes?
I haven't. No.
I'm so curious all this time.
There's a trainer at my gym who wears them, and I do have to say, every time he walks in, I keep thinking, like, Frogman. It's a strange, they look so bizarre, but they're supposed to be very comfortable. I don't know. It's like people run in them. I don't get it. I don't get it. I'd be with you. I would send him back to the attic with those
I think it's
shoes.
Like they're the most ergonomic, the most like the way our body naturally is supposed to walk the
sure,
earth.
Sure. That's exactly right. Right.
But
yeah.
It's,
honestly, I think what's going to happen here is that people keep asking about the individual toe shoes. Like that's clearly... It's one of the, that's one of the four things that sticks into people's heads. So I can see my future where I look into them and go, people keep asking about this. I need to know more about these shoes and why people wear them. And then I'll read up and I'll go, oh, interesting. And then I'll go, maybe that's not terrible. Like 3 years from now, maybe I will be an individual toe shoe woman. Just
I want you,
because.
Actually.
You should go on book tour with them.
That's what I was going to say. You need to just show up and book, not say a word. And yeah, exactly. Create a sponsorship deal with one of these companies that make them.
But everyone's bringing that up to you?
Yeah, it's weird. But there are so many husbands who are in there for one sentence or two sentences.
Yeah.
And these are the ones that make people go, I agree. Or, oh, I quite like those. Don't
That's
know why.
Really?
He stands out along with the guy who shakes his junk. That's
Maybe it's because they don't want to meet me and immediately ask about naked husband.
They'll start with the warm-up. It's like getting into fetishes. Can we talk about the
but
feet?
But also, being naked in the attic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it like splinters? Aren't we?
Oh, we never just really down. Find out what was going on.
You know, that's it,
right. Right. I mean, he could have left his clothes up there. Who knows?
I know, that's true. Holly Gramazio, this has been so much fun.
It's so great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here.
We
cannot
really
wait
it.
For people to experience all of the husbands. Since this is your debut, I'll show you all the tabs that I have in your book.
Oh,
people
oh,
love
incredible.
It. People love it when I show them the tabs.
I love that. I have to appreciate that you stick to almost one color because I never do.
It's like the sheet that I have. They're all sort of one.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. This is, again, very shameful, but I just dog ear.
No, it's
for
fine.
Me,
some people do
it's
it.
About, I like will literally stick it directly onto
on the quote.
A line.
Oh, yes. Nice.
Yeah, yeah. So it's more
no, that's
about.
Good.
Yeah, yeah, and the dog year, sometimes I'll miss a dog year. So it's, yeah, that's okay. You're allowed to dog year and mark whatever you want. So one day you're going to, in your whether you're dreaming or whatever, you're going to be like, oh, now I know what a Jason looks like. And then please feel free to share it with me.
I absolutely will.
But congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much for having me along. This is such a fun chat.
Terrific. Really well. I'm sure we will not be the last to ask you about the toes, but...
But you will be the only ones who give me an opportunity to recount at length my experience of going to see High School Musical 3.
That's exactly
me.
Right. It's very
that,
on brand.
Who knows if that'll come up?
That's very on brand for gaze reading. So
I know exactly. So funny. Let's talk about Zac Efron for another 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Core memory unlocked. When I was in college, I had a shirtless poster of Zac Efron behind all my clothes in my closet. Totally forgot about that until right now. And on that note, Holly, have
a
wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you.
So we're recording this outro after this interview took place, and I got a DM from Holly where she let me know that she thought a bit more about what a Jason means to her. So let me just say, she thinks what Lauren meant was vaguely heroic because he comes right after a bad husband and was a rescuer. And he's Greek, so he's definitely the kind of and the Argonauts Jason, rather than cool kid in the 90s playground Jason. And I have to say, I was neither a cool kids on the playground in the 90s Jason, nor am I an and the Argonauts Jason.
And thankfully, you're not the Friday the 13th Jason.
No, I'm...
You're just me. You're just you. You're just Jason. Okay.
So thank you all for listening, and we will see you
next week.
Bye.